it astounds me how people turn from children into grown-ups, and somehow something along the way makes them think that they're not creative when they have clearly been as creative as possible in their childhood, because every single kid I've met is creative.
Welcome to How to Play in Slow Time, interviews on creativity, where artists pull back the curtain on their creative practices and share how they listen, play, embody, imagine, model, and collaborate towards discovering something new. In this episode, we hear from theatre maker, performer, puppeteer, and occupational therapist Alice Osborne. Alice shares how a mesmerising shadow puppetry display early in her training led her on a career path to explore the relationship between different expressive forms. Visual art, dance and puppetry, and ultimately to use those creative practices to support people in mental health distress.
I'm Alice Osborne, and I would say I'm a theatre maker. And inside being a theatre maker, I have been a performer, and then it sort of morphed into more directing in different capacities. It all started with dancing. And I suppose if you're a dancer as a kid, when you're not in dance lessons on the weekend and after school, you just can make up dances all the time. And so it's making work from the very beginning, I suppose, choreographing for yourself in the backyard. I'd always been interested in visual art, and it was that crossover with visual art and theatre, and also with movement and dance. Another woman just did a tiny little shadow show, a shadow puppetry show. We were outside and I saw this show that she did that only went for about a minute, but I just loved it. Well, there's endless puppetry. I mean, I suppose the two big sides of it, the most prominent ones, are this voice work and comedy and Muppet kind of stuff based in Bunraku, which is the little figure, and then focused on the movement and the visual storytelling and the emotions of it, which is, you know, the part that I suppose links really directly to dance and movement. If you can manipulate your own body, then you have a sense already of how to manipulate an object outside your body and to get it to communicate emotion. The spotlight is on the work that you're doing, not on you, not on the work you're doing inside you, but on the work you're doing through you. What does modelling mean? The way I've come at it is definitely that it's in gesture and movement and breath. If you remove that from the regular human, like an actor, for example, and you put it into an object, you have to sort of slow it down because it's harder for us to read. So we can all read the visual cues of a human all the time. That's what we're doing all the time. But with a puppet, it's a bit trickier because we have to kind of learn the language as we're sitting there watching it. And so you have to kind of turn it into like a flick book or a comic where it's happening in frames or in images that all link together. But so you've got to slow it down. And something about that, when you slow it down and you put it into something else, turns up the volume on it. People talk about it all the time where they see it and they could see the puppeteers there and then the puppeteers disappeared. But something about the way it reads for the audience, it becomes louder and it becomes clearer than if it was just with a human. I remember at my darling Patricia show, Africa, and we had Bryony Anderson had made the puppets. She's this great puppet maker. And she'd made their cheeks with foam in them. And I remember this little girl who I was operating, I could rest her head on her hand, like while her elbow was slumped on the table. The foam would give a little bit in her cheek. And I suppose it's that thing when the object becomes extremely human and then that second has nailed it and you can feel it and the audience can feel it. And yes, and then you have that feedback loop and you're like, ah. I work in a inpatient mental health unit. So the patients live there until they get better if they're having an acute mental health episode. And in that, as an occupational therapist, I run groups and I run a visual art group and I run a creativity group. And a lot of people say, oh, no, I'm not coming. I'm not creative. So I've called it Alice's Everyone is Creative Creativity Group. So occupational therapy is about what you're doing. So anything that's occupying your time, your life. If you've just had a baby, your occupation is keeping the baby alive and also connecting with the baby. So occupational therapists in a mental health space are very much about finding meaning in life through doing, through meaningful activity. Often if someone's found their way to hospital because of their mental health, the mental health crisis that they're in has sort of taken over their life, and so their life can be empty of activity. And so part of what I offer is this group program to offer meaningful activity. Basically, everything that I've ever done, I can use in the hospital. Recently, I went down to Terrapin in Hobart and ran a kind of a masterclass in puppetry. Up until now, everything's just been feeding from the arts into this occupational therapy work that I'm doing. But I went down to Hobart and ran this 3-day workshop in puppetry and performance. What was really nice was that I got inspired by the occupational therapy into the art space. And a lot of what we do in mental health occupational therapists is sensory interventions. We work with how we experience the world through our senses. And so it was fascinating. We were just working with some animal puppets, and there were tiny little scenarios. We did a lot of exercises in, oh, let's approach puppetry from a sensory perspective. Now, what happens if the puppet is leading through their sense of smell? Now, what happens if the puppet is leading through its sense of touch? What happens if the puppet is blind? And so putting all these sensory limits on the puppet, and it was amazing how it changed the reading of what was going on. And I was like, oh wow, this is a cool toolbox for puppetry. It astounds me how people turn from children into grown-ups, and somehow something along the way makes them think that they're not creative when they have clearly been as creative as possible in their childhood, because every single kid I've met is creative. Yes, it defines my everyday life. It defines my whole existence. It means simply accessing and acknowledging your imagination that we all have and that we're all born with, and that every single child you ever meet has, but that somehow through the tragedy of growing up gets blocked, blocked, blocked. It's fascinating because I think early childhood ends at about 7, and you see, if you've spent time with kids, you see that's when the sort of ego seems to land. That's when self-consciousness lands. It's like up until 7, they have no awareness of anything, and the creativity is free-flowing. And then suddenly at about 7, they go, oh, how am I presenting? Who's looking at me? What's happening here? All that sort of social cue, pack animal vocabulary comes in. So I guess maybe it starts there. I think it starts with inhibitions. I think I didn't have that doubting voice at all when I was a kid, and then it solidly landed like heavily in my 20s after finishing university, like when you're out in the world and you've got to like survive. Then it really, really landed and was unpleasant for a long time. And then as I've got older, it's gotten quieter and quieter. And I don't know, maybe as I get older, again, I've had kids and that's shifted my priorities. And now I don't care anymore about that voice. Now I just feel like, oh my God, anytime I can get into a rehearsal room or a studio, it's just so lucky and such a privilege, that as if you'd waste time worrying about it. I'm just 100% collaborative. So mine always start with conversations or some sort of interaction with another artist who I trust and am excited by and inspired by. And then it goes into an ongoing exchange. I can't do it by myself. So if you're working, you know, in a directing capacity with someone else on the outside, then yeah, it's pure relational joy usually to me if you get along with that person. And I suppose I've been quite lucky that, I don't know, I suppose I've only really made work with my friends or with someone I really admire and trust. You're entering an unknown space and it's always going to be nerve-wracking. But if you've got someone there that you're bouncing off and that you're encouraging, I find it makes me a better artist because I feel like you can encourage each other and encourage each other to take risks. That's basically just like an egg of positivity and go, let's try it, let's do it, don't worry about it, let's keep, and then push through the doubt, the forest of doubt, which you can feel coming from the admin and coming from above and coming from within. If you push through, usually you land on something and you can, and then you have a chance to show it because you've been able to experiment through that encouragement.
This episode is part of a series of interviews with extraordinary people talking about their creative practice. You can find the rest of the series wherever you go to get your podcasts. You can also purchase our book titled How to Play in Slow Time, which unpacks the theory, practice, and teaching approaches to creativity from Brill Publishers at brill.com. How to Play in Slow Time was created and produced by Charlotte Farrell, Alexandra Talamo, Brioni Trezise, and Maria White. Edited and scored with original music by Tom Hogan. Special thanks goes out to the Technical Resource Centre and the Creative Practice Lab at UNSW Sydney, where our podcast was recorded. UNSW Sydney exists on lands and waters that have been cared for since time immemorial by the Bidjigal people of the Eora Nation, whose sovereignty has never ceded. I'm Brioni Trezise, and we hope you'll join us on the next episode of How to Play in Slow Time, Interviews on Creativity.